Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm sitting here with Lindsay Willey, our chief sommelier at Foreman & Wolf, sitting in for Cindy Wolf today. And we have a guest with us, Patrick Carney. How are you, Patrick?
Good, Tony. Great to be here.
Take a couple of minutes and just run us through your resume, your wine resume, that is, so people know the perspective from which you're speaking.
Thank you. Well, I've started in Baltimore selling wine in 1989. I think I met you way back when you put the wine program together for Lenny Kaplan at the Polo Grill.
Yep, just a few minutes ago. Yeah, back in 1989.
That's correct. Yep. A long time ago. And basically I've been doing the same sort of thing ever since, representing wine to restaurants and retail in greater Baltimore. Left the distributor I was working for about 13 years a couple years ago and started my own wine brokerage, and I represent a handful of small producers primarily. Mostly wines, a couple of spirits, but these little guys need a mouthpiece, and that's kind of what I do.
So it makes you pretty ideally suited, in my experience, to be the Don Quixote in this conversation.
That is correct.
So what? Maybe think back over the years. What was the first thing that you thought you were going to be able to turn into a big thing that people would actually care about? That turned into a windmill.
Years ago, when I was working for FP Winter, we represented Salice Salentino, remember, from Tarpanaro. And that was the greatest wine, and we did real well with it, and I took it everywhere, and we got, you know, good distribution on the wine, but it never really sold through. That was the first of many.
That's funny. Mostly grapes that people don't see in the States too much. So, Lindsay, do you see these grapes, Primitivo, Negromaro, getting traction now? Are consumers starting to recognize or have an interest in these grapes?
I think they have a good response once they're exposed to them. I don't hear a lot of guests or clients coming and asking for those grapes by name, but describing the style of wines that they might be after, maybe after having ripe styles of Zinfandel from the U.S. or even Shiraz, you know, looking for ripeness but good versatility with food. You know, you take them to a good, well-made Primitivo, can be really versatile. And then, but I think it's more taking them there, and then their response to it tends to be very positive.
And U.S. consumers, I'm sure you've seen this your entire career. Salice Salentino sounds cool, sounds interesting, is a little scary and doesn't mean a whole lot to a consumer, but it seemed that the whole identifying with grapes that we do in the new world, that is the thing that they latch onto. That's one thing that hasn't changed, has it?
Absolutely key. What Lindsay said is absolutely correct. You need to draw comparisons to grape varieties that these consumers are familiar with. And it just happens to be a slight detour in style, but in the same broad classification, and I think that helps expand the consumer's, you know, portfolio, if you will, or their understanding.
European wines are almost all identified by place names. That, you know, if they've been growing this grape there for 1,500 years, guess what? It's probably just going to be the wine from this place. We've been growing the grape 40 or 50 years in a place, or maybe 40 or 50 months in a place. It's going to be this grape that's grown by so-and-so in this place, and it's an entirely different tradition, but that's the first one we all seem to see.
Absolutely. Who was it, Ponzo, that said once that Pinot Noir is a vector of the soil? You can grow Pinot Noir in a lab and it has absolutely no flavor. But when it grows in Burgundy, or a particular place in Burgundy, it tastes like that place. When it grows in New Zealand, it has a completely different profile.
Yeah, that's honestly, Oregon to me is an exciting thing, because all of a sudden they've started to figure out how to get the Pinots adapted for long enough to begin to figure out how to translate that soil.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So after Salice Salentino defeated you, let's talk about your next big loss on a wine that you thought was exciting and then didn't go over as well.
Could have been one with you, Tony. I'll never forget starting off a dinner with, instead of the customary champagne, we started off one of our dinners with Fino Sherries.
Yep, that's on my list of wines that nobody cares about.
It is.
But they're terrific wines. They're just absolutely delicious, and paired with the right foods, they're just wonderful. And I think we're now finally seeing some of these manzanillas and dry sherries taking off, but it's taking years. And
We live in a short attention span culture, and those are wines. Fino Sherry is a wine to have in a quiet moment.
Yeah,
there are certain things that are subtle enough, that are fine enough, that are light enough, that they're appreciated in literally in a quiet or a slow moment. Some of the things on our list are wines, I know that Lindsay and I are making the list, are wines sort of from another time or a different piece of culture that were appreciated more when a lifestyle was a little bit slower.
Yeah.
And not, you know, I recall that dinner, and that dinner began with Fino Sherry's, and the dinner was a dozen boisterous guys,
right,
who wanted to get together and get together for like the big exciting red wines. And that's a little bit like taking guys to a rock concert, and as a warm-up, you know, you're playing a violin concerto. And it's really, it's not the mood for that audience,
yeah,
regardless of how beautiful the violin concerto might be.
So, well, I thought you guys might have appreciated, but
we were not that refined at that moment in time. But thanks for overestimating us. So what else is on your list, Lindsay?
All right, so we touched on sherry a little bit. Merlot in general, I mean, really seems to have just been destroyed by marketing or...
Well, it's the effect of media. I mean, mm-hmm. That's...
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's one of the classic things where, you know, you'd know it because it, coming out of the 70s, going into the 80s, everything was cab, and then all of a sudden people were thinking, oh, Merlot, you know, it's smoother, right? You'd hear it. I mean, I would be working at a bar somewhere. I want a glass of red wine. Do you have any Merlot? You know, it's smoother.
Yeah, they couldn't get enough of it.
For a long time, they couldn't get enough of it. So everyone in California, they went nuts and planted it like crazy, right?
Yeah, well, in California, and then some folks were sourcing it out of France or whatever. That was even before they started sourcing Pinot out of France when that craze hit, but yeah.
And so then by the time you get to the 90s, it's pretty ubiquitous, and the quality started to drop because it's being planted everywhere. Where you had all kinds of vines that used to be Chardonnay or that used to be gotten anything, you know,
sure.
Maybe Primitivo or something got grafted over to Merlot. So that grapes all adapt differently to different sites. There was a lot of abhorrent stuff being made with that name on the label. And the entire time, people don't even connect some of the most famous and pricey wines in the world of Pomerol and Saint-Emilion with Merlot.
With Merlot.
And then... By the time you get to the 2000s, Merlot is last thing on the list. I watched it through the 90s. I watched my categories on wine list get smaller and smaller and smaller as people didn't care at all.
Yeah.
I think we opened Vin 604 without a Merlot section.
Amazing.
You know,
amazing.
That in 2001, that's like the, and then right after that, the movie Sideways came out.
Right. And that killed it.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti was the death knell for
right.
Merlot.
Refusal to, and then you hear people say, I like everything but Merlot.
yeah. Well, it's the whole, like, I don't want to be that uncool.
Right.
I don't want to be that uninteresting. I don't want to be that predictable. I don't want to be behind, because wine choices end up becoming like a style thing. And
wine?
Part of your personal projection or whatever. And even in the movie, the thing that cracked me up in the movie... The Bordeaux, that's the holy grail wine, is a Merlot-based wine.
That he drinks at the end.
Yeah.
That they drink at the end of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. These wine trends, they travel along the social circuit, and people get together on weekends or the evenings, and they talk about things, and you can just watch these trends, you know, ebb and flow through what I call the cocktail circuit or the social circuit.
Absolutely.
It's amazing the way this business sort of, you know, reflects its trends.
Well, it's that whole, what Lindsay was talking about in the first segment, where people grab on to anything that they know.
Yeah.
So tell us some other large failures you've had in promoting.
Oh, there have been many.
In promoting, you know, something you thought was going to be special and go over well.
This guy brings up an interesting story, because you and I were in Piedmont years ago, and we had...
Piemonte, the region famous for Barolo in the northwest of Italy.
Absolutely. And we were eating at a restaurant. We had the carne cruda, remember, with the raw chopped veal, very young olive oil, a little bit of cheese, and we had this Cavallotto Fresa. So You can tell us about what Fraza is.
Fraza. Thank you for taking my question of your failure and pointing it towards mine. So Fraza was the, he was the fifth Beatle, you know. As a grape, Fraza was the fifth Beatle. So in Piemonte, there are four grapes that are important. The one famous one for long aged wines, Nebbiolo, and then Dolcetto, and then Barbera. And Dolcetto and Barbera get consumed for sort of opposite purposes on an everyday basis, and some Barbera will actually age pretty well, and in very rare circumstances, some Dolcetto will age very well. And then there's this other grape, Fraza. And Fraza is sort of like a cruder cross almost between Dolcetto and Barbera. Not literally that, but just functionally it is. And it does well with fatty things, spicy things. It has a lot of acid. It has a certain level of bitterness to it. But the fruit comes across with that. And when it's applied to the right dish, it really sings and really cleans up the dish. And it's super functional with certain things like the carne cruda you're talking about. So thinking that I found this brilliant thing, you know, from 500 years ago, like it's a discovery, and I want to bring it and share it with my clients, you know, I'm like, how many years did I try to special order, you know, 20 or 30 cases of Fraza and bring it in? And the importer is always terrified of bringing this stuff in because they know it's not going to sell.
Right.
They've already run at this windmill enough times.
But so many of these esoteric varieties just pair so well with particular dishes, and I think that's where, again, drawing the parallels to a grape that people generally know about, and then pairing it with whatever that specific dish might be is very important. And that was just one of those magical, you know, pairings was Fraza and carne cruda. A lot of times I've been to Gingale and you've recommended, you know, something like a Lambrusco with some of the
Lambrusco is that's another one of the super uncool wines that with the right thing is amazing, and with
cured meats and things like that, just absolutely perfect, and people wouldn't think about that.
But, no, I mean, Lambrusco is that thing that, you know, if you're in high school in the 70s or early 80s, it was the thing that you would go and buy. The
senior prom, right?
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. There you go. And it's a red wine that's sparkling and a bit sweet and kind of lower in alcohol. And again, you can kind of drink it like soda pop. But the very good ones are pretty dry, not sweet.
Yeah.
And do incredibly well with prosciutto di Parma and various dried cheeses from that northeast part of Italy.
Do you remember the lunch that we had just recently where all we had, you know, the lunch was all cheese and cured meats, and we ate, there was no silverware, it was just, and we had that in sparkling Bonarda, and it was one of the best, you know, like your palate's just alive the whole time because you have the sparkling, you have the salt, you have fat.
It's the only way you can deal with that composition of a menu.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of medieval wine from medieval food, you
right.
know, there's like... We ate everything with our hands or with toothpicks, and
right.
there was a.
It was like two pieces of fruit, and then it was all.
So what the Italians call salumi, you know, all the different cured meats and cheese, and
it's another perfect pairing. That again, you need to get out of your comfort zone and find some of that no one really cares about, but it's just absolutely magical
in that right moment. Yeah.
So you brought with you a bottle of wine from Alsace.
Ah, Silvaner.
Yeah. So with just Alsace in general, okay. At what time over the last, you know, two and a half decades have you not thought that Alsace provided more quality for the price than any other white wine region in the world?
Absolutely. Unbelievable. You know, we sold the Weinbach wines for years, and we should sort of have a little moment for Laurence Faller, who passed away earlier this week. But she was remarkable and made some just unbelievable wines.
And, great family and great person.
And the estate still produces terrific wines, and the region does. But again, going back to what you said earlier about wines that have German-sounding names or just difficult to pronounce, and I think that's what Alsace sort of suffers from.
Well, that is the conundrum too, because it is the one region that some of them are German names, but it actually goes by the grapes. It's the one thing
it's
in France.
Easier.
Wait a minute, this is going to be easier.
Yes.
And even though it goes by the grapes, it has, you know, names like Buchler or Weinbach or Zinnenbrecht.
Right.
And then all of a sudden people become terrified again.
Yeah.
And the possibility that the wines might be slightly sweet.
Absolutely.
I think that's the whole, like, being perceived as being uncool thing. I mean, how many times do you have, when you talk to a guest at the tableside, how often does someone, when you say that something, how have you, the question I should ask is, how have you had to learn to phrase when something has a fruity personality or a lot of fruit flavor so that they don't have to think that the wine is going to be sweet, so that you can actually get them to try it?
Right. The sweet is one of those words, I mean, I try to ingrain in everyone. Unless you're talking about dessert wine, don't use it. So you can say ripe, you know, describe certain fruits that have a sort of vivacious expression. But if you even hint at the word sweet, it can kill the whole conversation.
Because people are terrified of being thought of as being, you know, simple people that just consume wines that are sweet.
Right. So some with, you know, certain wines, they may have, you know, Gewürztraminer is a grape variety that often smells very sweet. So you kind of have to set them up for the contrast. Right. But then the palate can be very minerally and dry. But if you don't let them know in advance, well, when you first smell it, you might think it's sweet, but I promise that it isn't. So that when they get the glass, they don't just, you know, give up right away before even tasting the wine.
Yeah, especially the Gewürztraminers from the north of Italy that are bone dry.
Yeah.
That's a deal breaker, and that's the whole thing we've talked about, where people, they think that it's going to be, they're going to be thought of as being uncool. You know, why do you drink wine? Well, the first motivation, it's funny, I remember teaching this class for years, the first motivation to drink wine, to become intoxicated.
Right.
Second motivation to drink wine, well, because you want to be perceived a certain way by the people around you. And it takes a while for people to actually get to the third one, which is the real one, which is, I drink the wine I choose because it tastes good and it works with what I wanted to do. So if the outcome is to sit on my porch and relax, I choose something for that. What would you choose for that, Patrick?
Well, I like this little Lacrima di Mora di Alba because it's wonderful.
That you're never ever going to sell that wine. Lacrima di Mora di Alba. Okay.
Absolutely beautiful wine. It has this floral quality to it. A lavender element to it. It's sort of the liver of the wine world. People either love it or they hate it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine and discuss a few more wines that no one cares about when we come back.